Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're stepping away from the lab bench, straight into the clinic. We're going to focus on a really common but diagnostically tricky spinal issue, Shoreman's kyphosis.
Yeah, it's one where precision is absolutely key, especially with measurements and, you know, classification.
Getting it right matters.
It really does, because with adolescents, telling the difference between, say, just bad posture and a fixed structural problem like Shoreman's kyphosis or SK, well, that's crucial.
Definitely. Okay, yeah. So let's set the stage. We're going to talk about the Shoreman's kyphosis chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook, www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayette. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book.
Absolutely. Read the source.
Our goal here is to really boil down the essential clinical facts, the diagnostic criteria, and the treatment options for SK. We want to highlight those specific measurements that define it.
Sounds good.
So let's start right at the beginning. We talk about kyphosis, that sort of outward curve of the spine. But what's the key thing that tells us this isn't just slouching? And what's the angle we're looking for?
Okay, well, the number one defining feature is its rigidity. It's a stiff curve. But the first benchmark, the angle you mentioned, is that the kyphosis has to be greater than 45 degrees.
Greater than 45.
And normal is?
Normal average thoracic kyphosis is around 35 degrees, give or take. So 45 is definitely increased. And SK, it's this rigid sagittal plane, front-to-back plane deformity. It can happen in the thoracic spine, which is most common, or lower down in the thoracolumbar or even lumbar regions.
Got it. So 45 degrees gets you in the door, diagnostically speaking. But what's the really specific, non-negotiable thing you need to see on the x-ray to say, yes, this is definitely Shoreman's?
Right. The angle isn't enough on its own. The critical piece is the vertebral anterior wedging. Specifically, you need to see three or more vertebrae right next to each other, contiguous, that each have at least 5 degrees of anterior wedging.
Ah, okay. Three in a row, each wedged at least 5 degrees.
Exactly. It's that combination, the curve over 45 degrees, plus those three wedge segments that tells you it's structural.
That makes sense. It's that consecutive damage pattern.
Yeah.
What else might you see along with that wedging?
Well, besides the wedging, you often see other things like irregularities on the vertebral end plates, the top and bottom surfaces of the vertebrae. That can lead to the disc spaces getting narrower.
Okay.
And sometimes you see Schmorl's nodes, which we can talk about.
Mm.
Another key feature is the sort of posterior overgrowth. It's like the back part of the vertebrae keeps growing normally while the front is compressed or wedged.
Which contributes to that hunched look.
Precisely. That combination front compression, back height creates that rigid, rounded appearance. And critically, the curve just doesn't straighten out much, even when the patient tries to actively extend or arch back.
That inflexibility again. Okay, so we know what it looks like radiographically, but why does it happen? The textbook mentioned the cause is still a bit murky. Yeah, it's kind of surprising, isn't it? For something relatively common, the exact etiology, the why, is still technically unknown. But we have several leading theories. Shoreman himself, way back, thought it was related to osteonecrosis, basically, impaired blood supply, leading to tissue death of the vertebral ring apophysis. That's the growth plate area at the edge of the vertebral body.
So a growth disturbance at the front.
Right, which fits perfectly with the anterior wedging we see.
Makes sense. Ooh. What other ideas are out there?
Well, there's Schmorl's theory. That's more biomechanical. It suggests that disc material actually herniates through the end plate into the vertebral body.
Like those Schmorl's nodes you mentioned.
Exactly. The idea is that this weakens the end plate, allows the herniation, and contributes to the loss of anterior height, causing the wedging. Beyond those, other potential factors include maybe some subtle growth hormone issues or even a relative osteoporosis, making the bone softer and more prone to compression. And a really big one, genetics. There seems to be a strong genetic component.
Interesting. How strong is that link?
Pretty significant. Studies show a high rate of heritability. It often follows an autosomal dominant pattern, meaning you only need one copy of the gene.
So it runs in families.
It definitely can, though how strongly it shows up, the penetrance can vary. But yeah, it points towards SK being more of a developmental condition than something caused by, say, an injury.
Okay, let's shift to the clinic. Who typically gets this? What's the usual presentation?
We usually see this pop up in adolescence. Onset is typically around 10 to 12 years old, often right during that major growth spurt.
Right, where they're shooting up.
Exactly. It's actually the most common cause of structural kyphosis in that age group. It affects boys and girls pretty much equally. And the prevalence, how common it is overall, can range quite a bit, maybe from 0.4% up to, some studies suggest, even 10% of the population.
Wow, that's a wider range than I'd have thought.
It is. And the most common type involves the thoracic spine, with the peak or apex of the curve usually somewhere between T6 and T8.
And when someone develops that fixed curve in their mid-back, the body has to adjust, right, to stay
Yeah.
balanced.
Absolutely. The spine always tries to keep your head centered over your pelvis and your eyes level. So with that increased thoracic kyphosis, you'll often see a compensatory hyperlordosis, an increased inward curve develop either in the lower back, the lumbar spine, or sometimes in the neck, the cervical spine.
And that compensation can cause its own problems.
It can. Clinically, you might see secondary issues like muscle tightness. The hamstrings often get tight, and so does the iliac, so is the hip flexor muscle. It's all part of the body trying to find a new equilibrium. So when you're evaluating someone, you have to look at the whole picture, not just the thoracic curve.
Right, that global spinal balance is key. Which brings us back to diagnosis.
Exactly.
Okay, quick reminder for everyone listening. We have been talking about a chapter from the free and peer-reviewed textbook, Orthopedia, at www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vea. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book.
Definitely read the book.
All right, so the patient's in the clinic, they have that characteristic posture, maybe some back pain. We stacked SK. What imaging do we absolutely need?
You need x-rays, specifically AP front-to-back and lateral side-view radiographs. And here's a really important point. You need the entire spine on those films, from the neck down to the pelvis.
Why the whole spine?
Because you need to assess that global alignment, see those compensatory curves we talked about, and check if the curve extends into the thoracolumbar region. You also need it to properly assess sagittal balance.
Okay, so on that key lateral view, besides confirming the curve is over 45 degrees and checking for the three wedged vertebrae, what else are you looking for?
You're confirming the rigidity visually, looking for those end plate irregularities we discussed, maybe spotting Schmorl's nodes. And you're formally assessing sagittal balance, usually using the C7 plumb line, dropping a vertical line from the C7 vertebra and seeing where it falls relative to the back of the sacrum. It tells you if the patient's overall posture is shifted forward or backward.
Got it. Now, if a kid just has bad posture, their back might look rounded too. What's the definitive test? The one that really separates structural Shoremans from flexible postural kyphosis?
That key test is the supine hyperextension lateral X-ray.
Supine hyperextension. So lying on their back and arching over something.
Exactly. Usually over a bolster placed at the apex of the curve. This passively pushes the spine into extension. The crucial finding is that in Shoremans, the kyphosis is relatively inflexible. The curve won't straighten out significantly on that hyperextension film.
Whereas postural kyphosis would.
Postural kyphosis would largely correct. It's flexible. That rigidity, or lack thereof, is the defining difference.
That makes perfect sense. That inflexibility is the hallmark.
Yeah.
Well, let's quickly touch on other things that could be the differential diagnosis. Postural is number one.
Right. Postural kyphosis is the main one to differentiate. Key differences. It corrects with extension, and you don't see that anterior vertebral wedging on the X-rays.
What else should be on the radar?
You should consider vertebral compression fractures, although that's usually in older osteoporotic individuals, typically females. There's also congenital kyphosis, where someone's born with malformed or fused vertebrae causing the curve. That looks different on X-ray. And less commonly now, nutritional issues like rickets from severe vitamin D deficiency could cause the kyphosis. But again, the context in x-rays would usually point you elsewhere. Ruling these out confirms the SK diagnosis.
Okay, diagnosis confirmed. Now, how do we manage it? It sounds like treatment really depends on how old the patient is specifically, how much growth they have left, and how big the curve is.
That's exactly right. For mild to moderate curves, let's say roughly less than 50 degrees, up to maybe 75 or 80 degrees, especially if pain isn't severe and it's not rapidly progressing, non-operative treatment is the way to go.
And what does that involve?
It's usually a combination of things: stretching exercises, physical therapy focusing on improving posture, strengthening the back extensor muscles, and core strengthening. And importantly, regular checkups with x-rays to monitor the curve, especially during growth spurts.
What about bracing? You hear about that for scoliosis. Does it work here?
It can, but with some important caveats. An extension-type brace can be used, but, and this is key, it's generally only effective if the patient is still growing significantly. If they're skeletally mature, bracing probably won't achieve much correction.
And the goal isn't necessarily to straighten it completely.
No, the main goal of bracing an SK is to stop the curve from getting worse during the remaining growth period. Maybe get some minor correction, but mostly preventing progression. And the other big factor is compliance. The patient typically needs to wear it for many hours a day, like 16 to 23 hours.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds tough for a teenager.
It is. Compliance is often the biggest challenge with bracing.
Okay, so if non-operative treatment isn't enough, or if the curve is already really severe when diagnosed, when do you start thinking about surgery?
Surgery is generally reserved for the more severe end of the spectrum. There isn't one magic number, but curves greater than, say, 80 degrees, especially if they're causing significant pain or are clearly getting worse despite non-op treatment, might be candidates.
Any other triggers for surgery?
Yes. Other definite indications would be documented progression of a severe curve, pain that's debilitating and doesn't respond to other measures, or although it's rare, any signs of neurologic problems like spinal cord compression.
And surgically correcting a stiff, rigid curve like this must be complex. What's the usual approach?
The standard now is a posterior approach from the back. It involves spinal fusion with instrumentation, usually pedicle screws and rods, to stabilize the spine in a more corrected position.
Is an anterior approach ever needed from the front?
Much less common these days. The posterior approach with modern techniques is usually sufficient. Now, to deal with that rigidity you mentioned, surgeons often need to perform osteotomies, essentially, cutting through bone to make the spine more flexible before correction.
Like breaking it to reset it, basically.
Sort of. A common technique is the Ponti osteotomy done posteriorly. Each osteotomy can provide maybe 5 to 10 degrees of correction at that level. So for a really big, stiff curve, you might need multiple Ponti osteotomies.
And safety during all this.
Absolutely critical. Intraoperative neuromonitoring, continuously checking spinal cord function during the surgery, is the standard of care. Mandatory.
Makes sense. Thinking long term, what's the prognosis? Are there curve sizes that predict outcomes?
Generally, yeah. Curves that remain less than 60 degrees usually have a pretty good long-term outlook. Patients typically function well, often just with non-operative management.
But what about the really big curves?
That's where function can become an issue. The major cutoff to remember is around 100 degrees. Thoracic kyphosis greater than 100 degrees is associated with clinically significant impairment in pulmonary function. It affects breathing.
Over 100 degrees impacts lung function. That's a critical threshold.
It really is. It's a major reason why intervention is considered for those very severe curves, even beyond just pain or appearance.
Okay, that link between the spinal structure and lung function is powerful. Let's make sure everyone listening really grabs the key concepts. Can we do a quick review of the top 5 terms?
Sure. Let's hit the highlights. First, kyphosis. For SK, we mean that convex spinal curve greater than 45 degrees.
Got it. Second.
Lordosis. That's the opposite. Concave curve. Often seen as a compensatory curve in the neck or low back with SK.
Third.
Vertebral anterior wedging. This is the big radiographic sign. Remember, 3 or more consecutive vertebrae, each wedged at least 5 degrees anteriorly. That defines structural SK.
Okay. Fourth term.
Schmorl's node. That associated finding, thought to be from disc material pushing through the end plate, links to one of the etiology theories.
And finally, the crucial clinical distinction.
Shoreman's kyphosis versus postural kyphosis. The absolute key difference is rigidity. SK is relatively inflexible, while postural kyphosis is flexible. That hyperextension x-ray proves it.
Perfect. It really drives home that diagnosing SK isn't just about getting out the protractor. It's a whole process of confirming those structural changes and ruling out flexibility.
Exactly. It's about the angle, the wedging, and the rigidity. Mm. And thinking practically, you need to remember those thresholds. Under 60 degrees, probably okay long term. Over 100 degrees, you need to worry about pulmonary function. That guides your management significantly.
Excellent points. A really thorough look at a complex condition. We have just discussed a chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine.
Orthopedia.
Orthopedia by Bernstein, Pinney, and Viatt. It's available at www.orthopedia.com at no charge. And again, before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book. You'll be glad you did.